Rich Kimble here, Bruce Pratt at Sports Lit 101 time. And we're joined on the G&M Family Market phone line by one of the contributors to this terrific collection that we've talked about quite a bit, Replays, Rivalries, and Rumbles. Chad Carlson joins us, and his piece for this is terrific on the NCAA basketball tournament, March Madness, or Madness in March. Chad, thank you so much for being with us.
And thanks for having me.
Could anybody have imagined back in 1939 that this little basketball tournament would become what it's turned into these days?
I have a hard time believing that, and that's one of the fun things about this story. It has grown and grown and grown.
Now, of the two things that the NCAA touts the most, would be March Madness and then the football bowl series championship. Do you see a time when that could cause a problem for them, having these two big events?
Well, I certainly do, and I think the unique thing right now is that the NCAA takes on all the revenue of March Madness, and yet college football bowls have traditionally not gone to the NCAA. They've gone directly to the conferences and the schools. And so yet this March Madness deal, this basketball deal, actually means more to the coffers of the NCAA than football has historically. And so that's one of the unique things about these two, and maybe in that sense they've been able to coexist because they dole out their finances differently. But these are two major events that have grown and grown and grown, and in some sense, that's the way all our sport happens, right? We can consume it at ever-increasing levels. So we've got this basketball tournament that has grown. It started with 8 teams, and now it's at 68. And I wonder about the football playoff, if that has the same trajectory, starting with 4 teams, and maybe that'll grow too.
Well, I was going to sort of follow up with a question a little bit like that. Now, we've seen the role of what ESPN played and secondary networks, if you will, at the time, in covering all the basketball games. You could see every game in the tournament between, I guess it was Turner and ESPN. As Travis Vogan has pointed out a number of times when he's been on with us, the media has had a lot to do with this, and that has even further enhanced the revenue for the NCAA and further made the players and the universities more servants in this.
That's certainly the case. They've absolutely been the seed of growth in all of this. And so as we look back at the financial records of NCAA March Madness tournaments, way back to 1939, there were no broadcasting rights fees. You know, all the money that came in from ticket sales and program sales. And so it was really important where the event was held. But once we got into the 50s and 60s, we start to see some broadcasting rights. We start to see them grow exponentially. And the television networks really are what spurred so much of this growth that we see the tournament going very quickly from 32 to 64 teams in the late 70s and early 80s, once the television networks realized, you know, how much potential there was and how much viewership was of interest to the public. And so that has absolutely been a spur to all of this. And like you said, now we can watch any game we want, and that was certainly not always the case.
Chad, back in the 30s, there were two other competing tournaments, the NAIB and the NIT, and you write about those. What was the turning point that allowed the NCAA tournament to eclipse those others?
Well, both of those were seen as competitors early on. The NAIB tournament, which is now called the NAIA tournament, in fact, just started today, is an event that was geared towards smaller schools, and that was seen as a little bit more parochial. And so the NCAA didn't worry itself so much with that event, especially once they captured the host city of that event, which is Kansas City. Once the NCAA got established there in 1940, that no longer became an issue. But the big competitor was the NIT. And, in fact, that was a tournament that was more prestigious early on, mostly because it was centered in New York City, which had the largest arena, Madison Square Garden, and it was in the media mecca of the country and of the world. And so the NCAA had its eyes on New York City and was able to work out a deal where they could coexist with the NIT in Madison Square Garden in 1943, and that really allowed it to sort of play in and become equivalent with the NIT in terms of its popularity and in terms of its media reach. Now, during World War II, 1943, 44, and 45, at the end of those seasons, the NIT champion played against the NCAA champion in what was a Red Cross benefit game. All proceeds from the game went to the Red Cross War Benefit Fund, and the NCAA champion won all three of those games. And so and at that point in time, the public, specifically those in New York City who had always been biased towards the NIT, started to believe and realize that the NCAA was as good, if not better, a tournament. And from there, slowly, the tide turned. Another important moment was 1951, when we have a gambling and point-shaving scandal that was based out of New York City and Madison Square Garden. The NCAA was able to escape from culpability in that scandal, but the NIT was not, because it was a New York City and a Madison Square Garden-based tournament.
I mentioned earlier the tension sometimes between football and basketball. I mean, football is the reason that the greatest basketball conference of all time, the Big East, ended up being broken up. Do you see that the movement towards getting pay for players, or getting more opportunity for players, the Ed O'Bannon kind of thing, do you see that being more something that comes out of basketball or something that comes out of football?
Well, it's unique that you're right. You're absolutely right. So much of the movement among conferences and so much of what athletic departments do is based on football, right? That's the engine that drives everything. And yet when it comes to individual athletes and their ability to capitalize on their own star status, there really isn't a better sport than basketball in terms of the college ranks for a player to cash in on his own name, image, and likeness. And that's simply because of the logistics of the game. You're playing without a mask on like you are in football. You're playing sort of exposed to the public. And basketball is a game that only has five players on a team on the court at a time. And so one star can really take over. And we see in football, I suppose, the way that players cash in on their name, image, and likeness is sort of, I would say, focused in on some of the more prominent positions. And so there's really only a number of positions that in which players can get endorsements, for instance, that will be super lucrative. And so I think there's a difference there in terms of the nature of the sport. Basketball is just a little bit more exposed, fewer players, more star value in any position. And in football, it's limited. So I see that as being a little bit of a difference in which I might say, you know, basketball is probably more susceptible to, you know, the environmental stimuli that would potentially allow us to potentially, you know, pay players. Football is not immune. I think football would be there too, certainly, especially with the stars. But as in terms of the percentage of the number of players that can benefit from that, it might be different.
So this ongoing FBI investigation, is that likely to have any impact on this year's tournament, other than the whispers and talk about certain teams, certain schools, and coaches?
Yeah, I think that's a part of it, the whispers, you know. But this is an event that is so it's so financially crucial to so many colleges and conferences. And so, you know, the whispers about, well, maybe Louisville would turn down a bid if they were offered a bid. You know, maybe there's a possibility of that. But if Louisville turns down a bid, that means that there's less money going towards their conference. So it's not just a Louisville decision. It's a conference decision for them. And so I'm not sure that we would see a lot of that. However, that it's a specter that looms. You know, it's looming around all of this. And you wonder at what point any off-the-court issues would affect the viewership and the consumption of the public. For instance, what we saw in the NFL this year, you know, ratings were down a little bit, and it may have been simply because there were so many off-the-field issues that people no longer felt that when they turned on football on Sundays, they were able to escape from the real world, you know, and be entertained and so forth. You wonder what the breaking point would be for college basketball. I don't think we're there yet, but there's the potential that we might have less appetite this year for it, because we know more about the seedy underside of the game.
No doubt about that. Chad Carlson, to read his terrific piece as part of Replays, Rivalries, and Rumbles, a wonderful collection. Chad, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Chad.
Thank you.
15 minutes to go before the top of the hour here on Downtown. What's up next week, Bruce? You're on the road, right?
Yeah, and I want to talk about an absolutely astounding book, The Rebounders, The Division I Basketball Journey by Amanda Ottaway, who was a player at Davidson College at the same time that Steph Curry was there. She went with big dreams. They didn't all turn out. If you want to really see how basketball is a brutal sport because of the length and breadth of the season. It starts in August, it ends in March. It's a long grind. They do a lot of traveling. I was with women's basketball at Maine for 3 years. I know this. I've seen it personally. This book is written by a really bright woman, and it's a great book, and it's called Rebounders, The Rebounders from Nebraska. It's really good. We'll talk about that, and then we have a poetry collection to talk about the week after that.
And speaking of the NCAA tournament and the whole concept of paying players, and one of the big advocates of that has been friend of the program, Patrick Ruby. He's got a terrific piece out now on Deadspin, and he'll be on with us next Tuesday to talk about it on the cusp of the NCAA basketball tournament.
He's great. When he's on with us or he's on with Bill Littlefield, he's great. I like Patrick Ruby a lot.
Absolutely.